Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 6th day of February, or I suppose the 37th day of Anno Domini 2021. And you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 7 minutes after the hour, we are going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. Here comes the news. Before I tell you the news, I will tell you the numbers to call. And you can give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Or you can text us at 585-205-8887. But please, give us enough information to be able to answer your question. Okay, it's more important than usual to update to the latest version of Chrome, version 88.0.4324.150, at least, of Google's browser, released on Thursday, fixes a vulnerability in which the search giant said is actively being exploited in the wild. The update is rolling out now across Windows, Mac, and Linux. Yes, Mac and Linux users should take note that they are just as vulnerable as Windows users. Stop being smug. It isn't justified. Google isn't providing specific details about the vulnerability, quote, until a majority of users are updated with a fix, unquote. But it's interesting to note that the date Google says the bug was reported, January 24th, is just one day before Google's threat analysis group publicly disclosed a hacking campaign that appeared to be relying in part on an unpatched vulnerability in Chrome. Just a coinkydink, I'm sure. It said government-backed hackers based in North Korea had set up a blog to lure their targets to, which would infect their machines even if they were running fully patched software. Regardless of the exact bug being patched, it's more important than usual to ensure you're running the latest version of Chrome. Although the browser's update process is basically automatic, you can accelerate things, force an update in the About Chrome menu, and also, of course, check to make sure you're on version 88. At the very least, hit that three-dot menu in the upper right, select Help, then About Google Chrome, and make sure that the version starts with 88. And our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Chrome 88 update includes vital security fix. And your choices are, I'm already updated, I'll check immediately, I'll get around to it, Chrome what now, and of course, other. So far we have 21 votes, and Chrome what now is first, followed pretty closely to I'm already updated, followed by I'll get around to it, one vote for I'll check immediately, and one other. And of course, if you did vote other, then head on over to soundbites.org, scroll down on the right under fascinating stuff, and you'll see the forums. The second forum down is the poll discussion. Currently, at least, the number one item under poll discussion is 6 Feb 21, Chrome 88 update includes vital security fix. And, of course, you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415, or text us at 585-205-8887. But if you text us, give us enough information to answer your question. Again, let me reiterate, if you are a Mac or a Linux user and you're using Chrome, you are just as vulnerable. Or any Chrome-based browser, I suspect Edge, or you know, any of the alternative Chromium-based browsers have the same vulnerability. So please make sure you update immediately. Sorry. All right, let's head to the phones. Our first caller is Larry from Rochester, New York. Hi, Larry. What's up?
Good afternoon, guys. I always call early and often.
You should. The Chicago way.
After talking to you last week, I've got my Linux machine. Oh, excuse me, Linux. Yeah, I guess it is Linux. I've got my Pi up and going. However, I have a 64-gigabyte micro SD card,
a
new version. I went to the Pi website, used their latest format, download, and everything. However, when I check it with my Mac machine and look at it, it says that disk has 213 megabytes available of 264 megabytes. But it still says it has a 63.9 gigabyte disk. I don't quite get what's going on here.
And what machine are you checking it in?
I have a Mac. I formatted it on the Mac and everything. Then I went to the Pi, RaspberryPi.org, and they have a new download system and to put noobs on it. And I went through all of that process. Everything seems to work fine when I boot up the Raspberry Pi, but I'm just curious as to why, when I look at the available space on the drive, it says it has 213.5 megabytes available, 264 megabytes. I mean, I don't get that.
Well, what does the Raspberry Pi say?
Oh, what does the Pi say?
Right.
Huh. I didn't do that.
Well, you should, because it is certainly not impossible that the Mac is misrepresenting.
Yeah, because the Pi usually likes to format it at 32-bit.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. When you formatted that on the Mac, did you format it in MS-DOS FAT32, or did you format it as GUID HFS? It probably needs to be the MS-DOS FAT32.
Well, the real question is, how does it look on... Well, I don't think it matters how he formatted it because of the Noob software. And it's N-O-O-B-S, which stands for New Out of Box. He didn't say nudes.
What did I say? News? I meant noob.
No, I heard noobs, and I knew what you meant. I just, for everybody else out there who might have heard nudes.
N-0-0-B.
At any rate, the Noob's software should reformat it to the format that the Raspberry Pi accepts.
Now, that's the only card in the Pi, is it? Or do you have another card that's your boot card?
No, this is the only card that's in the Pi. Yeah. When I look at what's actually on it, everything is there. The bootcode.bin, all of those things are there that they say should be there. But I just expected that I would see X amount of space for, the whatever it needs to drive the Pi, and then the rest of that 64 gigabytes or something would be free.
Right, and you're sure it is a 64 gig micro SD card?
Yes.
Okay, then the thing to do is on your Raspberry Pi, at the command line, type D as in dog, F as in Frank, space, dash, H as in human, and it will show you all your disk space, the size of the disk, the amount used, and the amount free.
Okay.
And that's what you should believe, because in terms of what the Mac is showing, if in fact the Noob's software reformatted the micro SD card, which it is supposed to do, it might have reformatted it to a format that the Mac does not readily understand, and the Mac might be misreporting the amount of space.
Okay, so could you repeat that again? That's D as in dog.
Right, D as in dog.
DF for disk formats.
Right, it's disk formats. D as in dog, F as in Frank, space, and then adding a dash H for human means it's in human readable format. So instead of getting, 1,500 zillion bytes, you get 1.5 gig.
I usually use capital H for that.
That works.
You get a slightly different format. It's in gigabytes rather than bytes.
Right.
Oh, okay. All right. I should have had the thing turned on when I asked you this question.
Well, that's all right. You can do it on your own. It's fine. Yeah, you get a slightly different size.
Yep.
But generally speaking, DF-H will give you every device on your system. So you'll see a bunch of stuff that, honestly, ignore it. It's temp files. Remember, everything in Linux is a device. Is a file. So all your devices are files. So you may see, a bunch of extra things that
okay.
Linux assumes are devices, files, but they're really your devices. And so the ones you want to look for are your slash, basically, which is the root directory. Maybe a slash boot.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of fair, but the rest of it you don't really need.
Okay. We'll get right on it. I wish I had this thing fired up now, but I'll fire it up and I'll get right on it.
There you go. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Have a great
Bye.
Week.
You.
Yeah. So there are lots of confusing bits
mm-hmm.
between all the various operating systems. And
then don't talk about the bytes.
And yeah, don't talk about the bytes versus the mebibytes and the megabytes.
Yeah, the megabytes versus mibibytes.
Mibibytes and yada, yada, yada. But the reality is that in general, DF minus H will give you what the Linux system thinks is on all of your devices, all of your file structures.
Right.
And so you can believe that. As opposed to what a different operating system thinks of a system that isn't designed for it.
One thing I set up my Pi to do Windows 10.
Yeah, I know.
And
it's an abomination, but okay, we'll let you get away with it this time.
But hanging the SSD drive off of it, setting it up as a file server, that is fast.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, I've got two other machines, well, actually three, that go to that machine now because I have one file out there that's an SQL file. And all three of them can be updating it. And it's like, boom, boom. I mean, I know.
Well, two things. First, you're sending it hardly any data at all.
Yeah.
That's first. Secondly, SQL was specifically designed to handle hundreds of millions of requests simultaneously. So three is not going to be a big deal for it. And third, you're on an SSD card, and it's going to be faster to begin with.
But four is right out.
Four is right out.
But before, on my old server, though, it would hang up, and it wouldn't always, between the three machines, it would lock up and, get hung up on one. Now, since I moved the file and that over to that drive, all three of them. I mean, I no sooner do an entry, and before I'd have to sit there and wait and wait.
Yep.
Then it finally go off. And, oh, yeah. Now I just hit enter. Oh, refreshing. Boom. Send it off.
Yeah. And then you get your system back, and it doesn't matter
how
long the server takes to actually update the file.
Mm-hmm.
It's off your machine, and you're back to normal.
Right.
So, yeah, absolutely. That's the beauty of having an external database server.
Yeah.
On your machine.
Just set it out there and that's all it does. And now I've set up other folders and all that to do, some more backup.
Right.
I figure it's a 2 terabyte drive. Nothing like, having another place. Now I've got 4 different places that I'm backing up stuff. And it's
exactly right.
That's okay. I could live with that.
I just, the other day I got my external container for my 3.5-inch 2 terabyte spinning drive. Cheap, slow Western Digital cheap spinning drive. And I put it on the Raspberry Pi, found it instantly, installed it, I just had to put in my sudo password, my super user pass, my root password.
Mm-hmm.
In order to say, yes, it's legit, go ahead and take it. But now it's set up, I can access it from anywhere on my network. Now what I'm going to do is make it yet another backup, and I'm probably going to make it a second. I haven't really researched it in decades, but there's a way to back up from a MySQL database
mm-hmm.
to another MySQL database. Essentially mirror it. So any change you make on one gets made on
oh,
the other.
Oh, so it goes up. Yeah, because my programs write it, and then every time that I close out of the program, it then I've got it set up to back up to another right. drive.
Right. So you're only vulnerable while you're running the program.
Yeah.
In this case, there would be zero vulnerability. It would immediately make a backup.
So once you make one change here, it's making the change over there.
Yep.
And keeping them in sync.
Yeah. I haven't done that yet, and I have to research it because it's been decades since I ever did it. But I know it's doable because I used to do it. And also, I didn't. I have backup. I've written code that dumps all my databases on my server, on my cloud servers,
right?
And I can download them every day, and I only keep the last seven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's.
Looks like there's a replication function built into MySQL version 8 and higher.
Right. I just haven't. It's been so long since I did it that it's hazy in my mind as to how it works, and so I just have to do it.
Yeah, just start typing commands. What's the worst that could happen?
Exactly. Right. I've been there. What's the worst? I said that to one of the guys who worked for me who was setting up a new drive. I said, "What's the worst that could happen?" So he did it, and he accidentally typed in the wrong drive letter.
Oops.
And reformatted the main drive of a server. Luckily, we had backups that were only an hour old.
So that wasn't quite the worst that could happen.
Yeah. Well, we found out the worst that could happen.
Well, no, it could have been one worse if there was no backup.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's when I was installing...
the penultimate worst.
The penultimate worst.
The Windows on my Raspberry Pi, they said, because you got to format the little SSD card.
Right.
And if he said it once, this person that I was following along with this video must have said it at least seven times, double check what drive you're writing or formatting to. Double check. Make sure you select the right one. Are you sure? And I mean, it's like you were worried that you.
Well, that's you
check
know
check and check. Well, yeah, because it's easier to double check than to sit there and
One of those things that makes you a systems administrator as opposed to somebody who's just screwing around is you double check. When I set up my new machine, I have a 1 terabyte SSD for my root directory where all the software lives and that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a 2 terabyte SSD where my files live. And I checked 4 times to make sure, yep, root is the 1 terabyte.
Yep.
And then I came back and looked again. Yeah. Yep, the root is 1. Home is 4, is the 2. I checked 4 times before.
Yeah,
that's
where I've gotten very paranoid way back from the old days. You know, you didn't want to accidentally format the wrong drive.
Yep. As a systems administrator, the number one thing you remember is you are not paranoid enough. And the second thing is you do not have enough backups, which is the corollary, really, to one.
I always try to format drives on a computer that only has 1 drive in it.
Yeah.
So that it won't format the boot drive.
Right.
And kind of make sure I've got the right drive selected.
All right. Back to the phones. We have Larry again from Rochester, New York.
I'm back.
Yep.
I did what you said. It's amazing. So I'm going to pull out my Linux book now and refresh myself with these commands. It is exactly what you and Dave said it would be, and everybody.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Did you just say we were right?
More than right.
More than right.
There's such thing.
We're recording this, right?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, Larry, go ahead.
Okay, I won't hold up your time, but it's exactly what you said. It's giving me the amount of space used, the percentage of it used, and everything. And so this is actually showing me what I suspected it should be,
right,
as opposed to what the Mac is saying it sees.
Right, and that just proves.
Who I believe.
Right.
Even a squirrel gets lucky once in a while.
Even a blind squirrel finds an acorn. So yeah, that's us. Thank you, Larry.
Okay, thank you guys.
We've recorded that, and we'll be playing that back at some point.
Yeah, rewind and rewind.
Right.
And one of the ways that Unix systems work is you may think you have one drive, which you probably do,
right.
But Unix itself splits it into four or five volumes even before you do anything.
Right. There's the root directory and the swap at the very least, yep. And home.
Yeah.
So those are generally three volumes that are on your one drive.
I've got dev as a volume, and I've got yep. private var VM as a volume.
Yep. I'm just on my Linux partition of my Chromebook, and I've got one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 partitions.
Wow, yeah.
16 file systems.
And PH is Python, right?
What?
Typically? I've got a volume in var, private var folders PH, and then what looks like a random gibberish of text, and then /t/apptranslocation, and another looks like a UUID code. So, and that's at 81% capacity, whatever that volume is.
I don't know. I'll take a look at the break.
PH is Python, I thought.
No,
PY is Python.
PY is Python. Yeah. All right, to the phones. Our next caller is Lee from Ontario. Is that Ontario, New York, or Ontario?
Yeah, up in the 315. We got your signal up here all day.
Excellent. What can we do for you, Lee?
I got a question. The funniest Wi-Fi network names you have ever had. I know you guys are joking around. I thought Pretty Fly for Wi-Fi. Just thoughts. I just need thoughts.
Yep. Well, I've seen lists of them. I like one that Your Music is Terrible, YOR. Your Music is Terrible. And then the one right below it is It's YOU apostrophe R is Terrible.
FBI van always comes in there.
Yeah. I've seen that one. I've seen Not Your Effing Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much my favorite one.
Yeah. Click this one, Grandma.
Yeah, right. I've seen that. I've heard of that, rather.
Yeah.
Most places are fairly boring.
Thou shalt not cover thy neighbor's Wi-Fi.
Right. But there are plenty of those, Lee.
It burns when I pee.
IP. Yeah, got it.
Abraham Linksys.
Abraham Linksys. I like that one.
Silence of the Lan.
Nice. There's plenty of horribly, horribly bad puns.
Yeah, I found one called the Top 20 Wi-Fi Names.
Oh, nice. All right, listen, we got to take a break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 29 minutes after the hour. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 1-800-790-0415. Text us at 585-205-8887. And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with a whole lot more sound bites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are sound bites. And this is a fascinating news item. Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, and Elon Musk's perpetual rival in the Seesaw World's Richest Man contest, announced on Tuesday that he is leaving the CEO post that he has led since 1994. Bezos will switch from the CEO spot to Amazon's executive chairmanship in Q3 of this year, he said in a staff email. Bezos' replacement as CEO will be Andy Jassy, J-A-S-S-Y, a key player in Amazon Web Services, the company's cloud computing division. Bezos, who is 57, plans to stay involved in product development. In the exec chair role, I intend to focus my energies and attention on new products and early initiatives. He's the richest man in the world. Andy is well known inside the company and has been at Amazon almost as long as I have. He will be an outstanding leader and he has my full confidence. Bezos wrote that he's proud of Amazon's $15 minimum wage and the climate pledge and said, I find my work meaningful and fun. I get to work with the smartest, most talented, most ingenious teammates. Moving from the CEO to executive chairman role will give Bezos time to focus on specific projects, he wrote. Being the CEO of Amazon is a deep responsibility and it's consuming, he wrote. When you have a responsibility like that, it's hard to put attention on anything else. As exec chair, I will say, easy for you to say, I will say engaged in important Amazon initiatives, but also with the time and energy I need to focus on the Day One Fund, the Bezos Earth Fund, Blue Origin, the Washington Post, and my other passions. I've never had more energy, and this isn't about retiring. I'm super passionate about the impact I think these organizations can have. Jassy built Amazon Web Services, or AWS, into big business and worked closely with Bezos before starting AWS. Prior to being appointed head of AWS, Jassy had been in what was known at Amazon as the technical assistant role working with Bezos. Amazon Web Services became commercially available in 2006, offering infrastructure as a service and other cloud computing capabilities. AWS has become one of Amazon's key businesses, and in full year 2020, it earned $45.4 billion in net sales and $13.5 billion in operating income. Jassy started the AWS team within Amazon in 2003. Three early AWS engineers described Jassy as an extraordinarily detail-focused manager with a photographic memory and a penchant for asking difficult and insightful technical questions. So, do you think anything will actually change at Amazon? Give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
AWS has more sales than Amazon itself.
It is very clear that particularly with this move, it is very clear how very important AWS is to Amazon. It is their number one.
And the warehouses are popping up all over the place. And he was also stating, though, that I guess he's got a number of other ventures within Amazon that he wants to explore in that. And this gives him the
Day One Fund, the Bezos Earth Fund, Blue Origin, the Washington Post.
Yeah, there's a number of them all that he wants to get into, and that's okay because he's not abandoning it, but he also sees that the direction most of it's going with AWS, though, being the biggest. I mean, look at now with Cyber Mondays and all that other stuff, and most folks, you know, with the...
Amazon Web Services is not sales, is not products.
Right.
AWS is
everyone else's website.
Everybody else's website. Exactly right. It's the back end website. So you can rent for 12 cents an hour a Mac Mini on AWS and do whatever you want with it. So it's not Amazon sales.
Right. But I mean, it's just a big conglomeration of stuff that, I mean, he's got his fingers in so many other things. That, you know, it won't dilute any of that.
Right.
Blue Origin has had some very successful rocket launch test missions. But SpaceX seems to get all the news, especially when Starship X blows up.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, if it bleeds, it leads. Blue Origin is boring because it generally works every time.
Yeah.
SpaceX, you never know.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the ironies is about SpaceX is the Falcon ship seems to be perfect and has launched almost 100% record, but the new Starship it doesn't seem to be working very well. And I'm thinking, why don't they just take some of the Falcon engineers and move them over to the Starship?
Right.
Because the Falcon guys know what's going on.
Right.
Well, they're still trying to iron out some other stuff within that. But I mean, so it's as rock solid. Yeah. You know, and as dependable as back in the day with the Challenger and all these other things.
There was a picture the other day of the two Starships on the launch pad with the sun rising right between them. It was a really neat picture.
That was
before it blew up. Yeah. Well, actually, the launch and the flight has been really good. It's the landing that's tricky. And the whole problem is sci-fi, 50 sci-fi books that always talked about spaceships landing vertically on a cone of rocket thrust.
Right.
And so that's what we're emulating now.
Right. Well, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, plus that was the anniversary this week of the
Challenger.
Columbia. We're both in January.
Where that exploded. And, you know, it's a sad thing. lost so many lives there. But, you know, through space, though, we've gained so much. You know, folks don't realize the science and technology that has come out of it. Simple thing like Velcro. A silly thing that you folks don't realize, like Velcro, that came from space. Same with duct tape.
Pretty much the computer you have in your pocket was spurred on by the space program, miniaturizing everything.
Yeah,
needing, no kidding.
Weight is the biggest thing. And being, like you said, get smaller and more refined and even, but not only getting it smaller and more refined, more powerful.
Yep.
Right.
You know, they just didn't, oh, yeah, well, we got to shrink this down. And that's why I'm still saying stupid phone companies, if they'd still learn with their phones, you know, yeah, you got them doing all these three camera angles and all this other hoopla on there. Give me more GD battery life.
Yeah, exactly.
The technology is there.
Well, excuse me, we just need to get wireless power. So rather than needing to, so right now the wireless chargers, you still have to make contact. If you could walk into a room and have your phone automatically start charging, that would be cool.
Didn't Tesla solve
Tesla figured that out 100 years ago.
In the 20s? Yeah. 100 years ago is exactly right.
But you need that giant 100-foot Wardenclyffe tower spewing out EM and
yeah,
RF.
Yeah, exactly.
And now, on 5G, now, one thing I've always questioned, because you know, I keep seeing more and more commercials for pushing the 5G and all that, which is line of sight. But one thing they haven't been saying is how much more a month is 5G over 4G.
Right. Most of the carriers are charging extra for the 5G phones and extra for the 5G service. And 5G is there's sort of two pieces of 5G. There's the 5G that's a little bit better, and that's where that's the one that sort of is most places.
Right.
And then there's the 5G that's really, really good, but only works a few yards away from line of sight, that little box.
Right.
The millimeter wave.
So if it's real 5G, if it was the fast 5G.
Well, and that's
5G,
the problem is they're both called 5G.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But if it was the fast 5G, you would see little towers everywhere. And, I mean, they'd be like fence pickets.
Yep.
They'd be
because
that far apart.
It's like Wi-Fi. You need one every couple hundred yards.
Right.
Well, that's the shame.
No, sorry, a couple hundred feet.
A couple hundred feet.
Yeah. So it'd be great for putting 100 of them in a football stadium for some big game that might be happening soon.
Right. But most 5G is not fast 5G.
Yeah.
It's slow 5G.
They call it sub-6 because it's sub-6 gigahertz.
Right.
Because for years, we've seen 5G on our Wi-Fi routers.
Right.
That's 5 gigahertz.
Right.
We're actually on Wi-Fi 6 at 5 gigahertz. Sixth generation of Wi-Fi at 6 gigahertz. Now we've got the fifth generation of cellular at 6 gigahertz.
Right.
So no one knows what's going on.
Right.
So check your carrier's coverage map and see what the 5G coverage is versus the millimeter wave coverage, which is going to be very tiny, and it's also very power hungry. One of the things that we saw in the new iPhone 12s is that if you like aren't streaming a video or downloading a big file, it won't use 5G because it doesn't need to as much, and then your battery doesn't drain so fast.
Right.
Yeah, and I've said this from day one. I'm sorry. I know a lot of folks like to sit there and watch the movies and all that. Well, you know what? I would rather be home watching a movie on a 32 or bigger screen than on that little postage stamp and paying that much more for 5G.
Back when we used to be out and about and we're in line a lot of places, you might want to stop and watch a movie.
Right.
But now we're not doing that.
Yeah, no, everything, you know, I mean, we've gone to, like they said, with Amazon and everything, you know, do you want it? Oh, you can order it, and a lot of stuff nowadays, you can get next day.
Yep.
It is crazy.
And we're starting to see Starlink, you know, back to Tesla. The Starlink satellites that are going up, there is an open beta now. You can go, it's probably starlink.com. I'll post a link. You can sign up for the public beta and be able to join in on the satellite internet service, which is kind of handy. When you're not at home, theoretically, it's going to be faster than cellular. depending on which G you're getting at the moment.
Right.
But that's another option, especially for outlying areas. People in the suburbs and in rural area, you often can't even get cable internet. So a lot of people are stuck with DSL, which is really slow. And you're hoping for cable, and people have been using satellite internet for a long time. And now it's starting to be more satellite companies are offering internet service, so that's helping to drive the prices down a bit.
Right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Reinhard in Rochester, New York. What's up, Reinhard?
Reinhard, Richard.
It says Reinhard, R-I-E. So I assumed it was an N that you were missing.
Didn't I write Richard?
Yeah. Well, if you may have. Sure. All right, we'll take Richard instead. Hi, Richard. What's up?
Yeah. Well, I wish I was Reinhardt. There was always two other Richards in my class when I was in school.
Right.
With no Reinhardts. But anyway, here's my question. I have a 2011 MacBook Pro. Perfectly happy with it. And now I've discovered that the software I use for my taxes will not work with whatever it is I have, High Sierra. So I don't particularly like the idea of having to buy a new computer just to do my taxes, but maybe it makes sense. I'm just wondering, is there an advantage to going with the latest and greatest for $1,200-$1,300, or should I find another way to do this? Or, I'm not a power user, so...
So you might...
Thoughts. What's that?
A lot of people look at the MacBook Pros... because they're the pro computer and they're big and powerful. But the MacBook Air is $300-$400 cheaper and is 90% the same, especially now with the new M1 processors. The biggest difference is it has a 7-core GPU and the Pro has an 8-core GPU.
Wow.
All right.
A whole core.
Yeah. And they're both 8-core CPUs.
Right.
Right.
So it's so for that $999 MacBook Air is an awful nice buy, and we're seeing a lot of people move up into that. And we have been running into a lot of people who are coming in, and their favorite tech software requires Mojave this year, and will require Catalina next year. So every year they're pushing you farther forward.
Right. Right. And so I guess the writing's on the wall. I do use it for I do CAD CAM work, and I use Illustrator on it.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing, is checking the programs you have to see if they're compatible with the new OS, because a lot of times that means you have to upgrade your software. The other option is to use a different tax preparation software, but you're probably going to run into similar issues with all of them.
Yeah.
Well, you can do your taxes online too.
In a web browser, yeah.
Yeah.
If it's not very complicated.
Right.
It is. It's complicated. So, okay. And will the MacBook Air run CAD CAM stuff and stuff like that, or do I really need a Pro?
Oh. One of the things we like to say is if you bill by the hour, you probably want to get a Pro. Because you can get more done, you can bill more.
You want a slower machine if you're paying
well,
no. billing by the hour.
Well, no, then you can get more done in the hour, and you can do more jobs.
Oh, yeah, okay, that's okay. Fair.
Yeah, I'm 75 years old. I'm not billing anything.
Yeah.
So. It's just for my own use. And, okay, and so what is the difference between the MacBook Pro and a MacBook Air? Like, what do you not have in Air?
Right now, it's very little difference. The biggest difference is the is the graphics core.
Oh. Oh.
Well, and any amount of RAM you can put in it, or?
Maybe. They start with 8. I think they both go to 16. The MacBook Pro, there are models where you can go to 64 gigs of RAM as you go higher up the product line.
But if you're not actually a professional,
yeah.
then
no.
16 gig of RAM is far more than the average user really needs.
And that's one of the things we're seeing now in a lot of computers, and especially the Macs, is that you can't upgrade the RAM, the internal RAM or storage, after you buy the computer.
Right.
Yeah.
So right now they come the base model, the $999 model, is 8 RAM and 256 storage. You can always add an external storage drive, but you can't add any more internal RAM. So a lot of people who plan, especially if you plan on keeping your machine for 5 or 10 years, you may want to upgrade to more RAM and more storage originally. But if you don't mind replacing it every 3 or 4 years, you get an even better machine every time it happens.
Yeah, well, I'm a 10-year guy, so
yep.
As you can tell with the 2011. Yeah, none of the applications require more than a gig RAM at this point.
Pretty much only until you get into the high-end photo editing and video editing. Some of the high-end CAD cam, if you're running like Vectorworks or Autodesk's stuff.
Fusion 360,
yeah.
Which is Autodesk, but it's not. I'm not doing anything really crazy and wild with it.
Yeah, the only times you really need more than 8 gig of RAM is if you're running very high-end programs or a lot of programs simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. No, it's not me.
And you don't want to wait for swap.
Yeah. No, I think I'm okay. Okay, well, that sounds good. Oh, so a whole other question. I would keep my 2011 machine. I'd keep that one home and then keep the newer machine at my shop. Is there an easy way to sync them so that if I make changes on files on one machine, that it would automatically change on the other machine?
Yeah, most of the companies have a syncing service. Apple's is iCloud, and their iCloud Drive will let you sync between devices. There's also Google Drive and Microsoft OneDrive, and there's Box.com, Dropbox. There's a bunch of different syncing services.
And you get a certain amount of space for free.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you can upgrade that if you want. And so if you just have a few files that you want to sync, then you may not need to buy much cloud space. If you want to sync everything, then you do may want to sync buy more cloud space.
Yeah, no, it would be just a few, I think. Yeah, okay, that's great. All right, well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
All right, thanks. Yeah.
That was supposed to be a C, but I curled it around.
See, it was R-I-E, H-A-R-D, and I thought it's either Richard or Reinhardt, and I guessed wrong.
My fast writing.
It's his fast writing. And he's, Dave is only doing about 62 things at once, so we cut him some slack about that. But it does mean every once in a while I'm not seeing what's actually written there.
Hold on.
Yeah. One of the things about the cloud storage programs is that your data lives on their cloud.
Right.
And all of your devices look up to their cloud to get the latest data. There is a program called SyncThing that is peer-to-peer and doesn't use a central server. So if you've got confidential or, HIPAA-type stuff, some people like that better.
Will it run between two remote locations?
Yes.
There you go.
The trick is if you haven't turned them both on, it may take a minute for it to sync down the changes. So they both have to be on and connected to the internet for all the changes to work its way through.
And what's that called again?
SyncThing.
You're going to put it on the...
Yep.
There you go. All right. So that'll be for Richard or Reinhardt. You can be anybody today.
And I'm pretty sure that one's cross-platform because Steve Gibson loves it.
There you go. So that's going to be on our website in just a minute. And we're going to go back to the phones and talk to Tom from Brighton, New York. Hiya, Tom. What's up?
Hi. Yeah, good afternoon. So you guys were talking a little while ago about phones and their capabilities and storage and things like that. The one feature that hasn't improved, in fact, it's somewhat decreased in terms of telephone technology, is sound quality, audio quality. In my opinion, the audio quality of most phones, most certainly most cell phones, is a little better, maybe even worse, than what Alexander Graham Bell heard when he was working with his phones back in 1876.
Yeah, yep. Remember the old commercials about hearing the pin drop? Nobody cares anymore.
Nobody cares anymore. Well, there's of course, a good reason for all of it. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, what you need is just slightly wider bandwidth on the audio channel to go, I don't know what it is now, it may maybe 300 to 400 hertz, and maybe move it up to 1.2 kilohertz at the most, and the sound quality would improve dramatically.
Yeah, but the first thing you have to remember is that almost no phone does audio anymore.
Right.
They do is data, and they just...
Sure.
So they're using the highest compression algorithm they can because... Almost nobody makes phone calls anymore. It's all data.
People still talk on the phone. Come on.
Not nearly as much.
And even now, that's not voice anymore. That's data packets.
Right.
What are we doing right now? We're talking, aren't we? You and me?
Yes, we are. But we are not the majority any longer. The majority is 16-year-old kids who spend all day on YouTube and WhatsApp and Instagram and all of that stuff and
Twitter.
Texting. And that's the vast majority of the people who are using cell phones these days. If you look at any of the data from any of the carriers, voice is very, very, very,
very small slice of the pie.
Very small.
And even some of that is voice over IP, which is back
and
to data.
Much of that is in fact, all of the dirty little secret is it's all data now. And when they charge you for data, they're just charging you for the data of video
and
audio.
Video, yeah.
But the data of voice and the data of text, they let that be unlimited. But it's all just the same data, all of it.
Yeah, but there's still important times when people need to speak with each other, hear each other clearly, unambiguously. Sometimes there are emergencies where you rely on voice communication.
Yep.
And the incremental cost of expanding that bandwidth on the audio side is inconsequential, even taking into account what you're saying.
Well, the thing of it, though, it is, Tom, is one thing that they've taken out of the phones that you don't see is the ability to play around with both the treble, the bass, and that within a device. Because most devices, you know, if you were to kick back on the bass and up the treble a little bit, you'd get a better quality.
Also, if you use the different compression algorithm, you'd get more of the highs and lows and more of the...
Yeah.
Stuff,
but they don't care. They're trying
to
do everything in one little box, just going down the center of the line.
Right.
And they don't care. You know, they figure there's going to be fall off on both sides.
The more compression they can use. And the problem is you can't compress digital much more than they're already compressing it. But you can compress voice down to almost nothing. Mm-hmm. Because the most incredible computer you've got is in your head. And it will fix many of the issues with audio quality. And yes, I completely agree with you. They should be definitely doing less compression and better sound quality. But they never will, because if you look at the data, it's the smallest part of their business.
Okay, great show. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. I wish it were different, but it isn't. All right. That music tells us we are done for the first hour of this show, but don't go too far. We're going to be back with a whole nother hour of Dave Enright, a whole nother hour of Steve Ray, and a whole nother hour of me, Nick Francesco. It is 59 minutes after the hour. You're halfway through the longest running computer show in the known universe. That's Soundbites right here on the Truly Great, and truly grateful to you that even with everything that's going on in the world today, we continue to be solely member supported because of your generosity, Jazz 90.1. We'll see you in just a couple of minutes.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece Rochester, a public service of the Greece Central School District, Jazz 90.1.
On Twitter at 901Jazz.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And it's 6 minutes after the hour. We're hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's Soundbites right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. You can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free, 1-800-790-0415. And while you do that, I will read another news item. A sudo bug, or if you prefer sudo, a sudo bug, S-U-D-O is sudo.
Yes. Sudo, super user do.
Yes, exactly.
Make me a sandwich.
Yes, sudo make me a sandwich. A sudo bug found in the Linux and BSD operating system, Berkeley standard distribution. The BSD operating system has now been found to also be present in Mac OS. So here's another reason for Mac people to stop pretending they're invulnerable. The news was confirmed by two security researchers. Notice that this is yet another Mac vulnerability that should be fixed. The bug could allow an ordinary user to gain root access to a Mac, though an attacker would also need to combine with a malware or brute force attack to gain user access in the first place. Sudo is an app that allows users to do things that would normally require root access. It allows a systems administrator to delegate authority by giving certain users the ability to run some commands as root or another user while providing an audit trail of the commands and their arguments. By default, sudo comes with a simple configuration, a single rule allowing a user or group of users to do practically anything. Basically, it's like running in as administrator in Windows. The bug was first discovered in Linux and BSD last month. Alarmingly, they discovered it has been present for at least 10 years. The researchers who discovered it said at the time that it was likely to be exploitable in other Unix-based operating systems, and it has now been found in Mac OS. Normally, there would be no public disclosure of this type of vulnerability until Apple had been given the opportunity to fix it. But in this case, it has already been speculated that the issue was present in Mac OS, so the bad guys have already been looking for it. So, still feeling secure with your Mac? Give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
There was a fix to a similar sudo bug they found last month, came out, and now we get another one for this month.
Exactly right. It's the monthly sudo bug.
Yeah.
It's a nice thing.
Apple has started acknowledging the CVEs and the person who discovered the bug now that they have a bug bounty program. They've never been very forthcoming about what bugs they're fixing or much detail about them because they don't want the bad guys to know. But the reality is the bad guys already know.
Yeah, right.
It's the script kiddies you don't want to know.
Right.
But they're starting to learn how to find out from the bad guys.
That's exactly right. The bad guys are selling the scripts.
Yep.
You know, even if you sell them at $10 when a million script kiddies all buy it, that's a lot of money.
And sort of the frustrating thing is if you're a security researcher, you could sell a bug to Apple for $100,000 or Microsoft for $100,000. You could sell it to the Zerodium bad guy clearinghouse for $500,000.
Right.
So you can make more money being a bad guy until you get caught.
Well, exactly. Exactly.
And so now, you know, being a bug hunter is now a legitimate and viable occupation. You can earn a living doing it if you're good.
Yep.
And every now and then, someone will get hired by the company they're finding bugs for. So we stop paying them all these bounties, and we'll just pay them a salary, which is less.
Yeah, that's less money.
It saves a heck of a lot of money.
Yep. Exactly right.
And become not part of ransomware.
Right. Right.
That's the big thing right now, the ransomware. And, you know, the hundreds of millions of dollars that are being exploited out of that, colleges and everything else that have been hacked during different times, and just all their data being held ransom.
That's have you heard any details on the Victor school district?
I have not. But so far, at least, fairly hush-hush.
The guess is it was ransomware, because that's the typical thing. It's been hitting a lot of different school districts, but they haven't said much of anything yet.
It is hard to protect your system. The best thing to do is have an off-site backup.
Non-connected backup.
Disconnected backup. Something to which you connect only to do backups.
Yep.
And that's it. And it's even better if you connect from the other end.
Yeah. Because a lot of times what the ransomware, once it gets into one computer, and reports back home, the ransomware authors will wait and rummage around the network for a while, find your backups, make sure they get encrypted, and then activate everything all at once.
Right. One of the things that we see more people beginning to do yet again is use video disks for backup because they're write-only.
Interesting.
So you write it, and once it's written, it can't be changed. Right?
It's kind of interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
Where do you find a video disc writer anymore?
Well, exactly. That's the hard part. I know people who are still using tape.
Yep.
I know a guy who's using a 25-year-old tape deck. He's having trouble finding new tapes, but the tape deck works like gangbusters.
Hey.
Well, it's an HP product, and you can't fill those with a hammer.
Think of it as, though, you can get SSD hard drives now, portable ones.
Yeah, except that it's hard to make them secure.
Yeah, no, what I'm saying, though, is you could have a bunch of them, you know, sitting in a safe and do a periodic backup.
Well, the real issue is that requires human intervention, and humans are fallible.
If you can
set it up to
But can you afford not to?
Well, exactly right.
That's the bigger question.
Right.
You know, how important is your data to you and your company?
Yep.
Is it worth the effort to take, you know, say on a Friday afternoon, Tom stops what he's doing, no fires or this or that. He stops, goes over, and backs up everything and puts it off in the safe. That is his job, say, for however long it takes.
Right.
See, and that's part of the problem is those operating costs don't have a return on investment.
Right.
So you can't say that I spent this much money, we sold this thing, and made a profit. No, we have to spend all this money on IT support, and if we do it right, we don't lose any money in an attack.
Right. Cost centers generally are less well thought of than profit centers.
Yeah. And we're starting to see now a lot of government agencies are banning the use of ransomware insurance and intermediaries. Because there's a whole new breed of you know, it's like the hostage rescue companies mm-hmm. that are coming up. We'll negotiate with they're doing the same thing now. If the ransomware wants $1 million, how about we give you $500,000 and you go away? So a lot of governments are now banning negotiation. They're banning paying it. But even if you have good backups, how much is it going to take for a school district with thousands of computers to erase and rebuild every single one of those computers, because you can't trust any of them now that one of them got infected?
And the other problem, of course, is, yes, ransomware, they've locked up all your data. But the more important question is, did they steal it first?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So then you know, they may charge you X hundreds of thousands of dollars to get your data back. And then on top of that, X hundreds of thousands of dollars not to sell your data.
Mm-hmm. So that's where Chromebooks are becoming more and more popular, because of, you know, like Steve was just saying, though, you know, if all those computers get infected on a Chrome network, it's no big deal just to wipe them, start them fresh.
Right.
And boom.
Well, and you got to wonder what Google and Amazon and Microsoft and Apple have for their data redundancies for all those cloud documents. We're just saying how big Amazon Web Services are. Do they have back their stuff up, or do you back your own Amazon Web Services up?
Well, I do know.
You should both, of course.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I do know that, like I said, I've got high friends in low places at Google. And I do know that they back up backups on top of backups all over the world, and that they also use Amazon Web Services. Mm-hmm. As yet another layer of backup, and a lot of places do, and it isn't inexpensive, but you know,
mm-hmm. There was a news story a couple of years ago about Apple's iCloud was using Microsoft Azure backend,
yeah.
And the irony of Apple using a Microsoft service.
Yep. But the truth is that Azure and Amazon Web Services and the Google stuff, that's where they make their money now. All of them are simply web services companies. Like you said, Amazon makes mm-hmm. more money at AWS than they do selling products to people. Google makes more money selling web services than it does on anything else.
Yep.
They're by far the number one email company in the world. And many of those people are paying a fee every year, $5 a month or whatever the number is. For email, because Google does such a good job of keeping your mail, making sure it doesn't disappear accidentally, and filtering out spam.
They filter out a lot of it, and it's great.
They're the best at that. And that's why companies will pay them, and they now make more money at that than they do at selling ads. And the same with every one of those companies, Yahoo, all of them, they make their money in those back end web services rather than the front facing stuff that you see. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic the way it's, you know, turned around so much in just the past few years.
Well, exactly.
You know, I mean,
it used to be everybody kept all their data on their home machines.
Yeah.
Now, particularly with something like Chromebooks, you don't need to do that anymore. And because of things like Chromebooks, people are much more comfortable keeping their stuff in the cloud.
Well, it's interesting, the cycles in the last 50 years of computers. You had a giant computer in the basement with all your data. Then we had PCs and distributed data. And then, you know, we went to thin clients where we had centralized data. And now we've got cloud storage, so it's now distributed data again.
Right.
What's going to be next? Right. Well, are we going to go back to centralized storage?
Well, and that's why you have so much stuff that you can do on your phone.
Yep.
I can write a book on my phone. It's painful, but I can do it because I don't need the storage on my phone. I get the storage whether I'm using iCloud or I'm using Google's.
And that's where I think, you know, things like school districts and everything else, it'll save them money if they go cloud-based versus, you know, a district office, say like Greece, since we're here in Greece. Instead of them having one mainframe there, it's up on the cloud. And if they're using Chromebooks, and even if you're at your desktop, you know, you can go ahead and just go into Google Docs and create Word documents and spreadsheets and everything. There's nothing there that you can't do. They can't do on a regular computer, and it's all protected because it's up in the cloud, and it doesn't become part of ransomware. So if you do get hacked, it's no big deal.
Right. The other big thing, of course, in terms of how businesses think, and whether that's a school district or a major corporation is unimportant at this point. The way a business thinks is, I need, and I hate to say this, I need fewer tech people.
Mm-hmm.
If Google is backing my stuff up, if Google is keeping their servers running, if Google's doing all that stuff, I don't need all those people in my back room. I don't have to pay the electricity. I don't have to pay the security. I don't have to buy new hardware.
Maintenance,
I don't have to pay human beings.
So much easier.
To sit and watch that stuff. And so they're finding they can get away with fewer, not with no people.
No.
You can't get away with no people. But you can get away with fewer people. And I hate to see that personally because so many people I know, you know, make their living doing that.
Well, and one of the ironies is that the IT manager sort of gets some of his perceived value with how many reports he has to him.
That's
how many
exactly
people report to him. And if you don't need that many people, you're in fact, we've seen,
I think these people, I think these systems administrators and tech people need to remind their manager that they are in fact being reported to by hundreds and thousands of people at Google.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cuz they're getting those reports.
Yeah.
And listen, people, let me give you a little bit of advice. Nobody else is going to toot your horn. Toot your own horn. I used to write graphs and charts and all kinds of stuff and send them to my boss every single month. I answered this many calls. We took this many stuff. I break it down. These many were Excel and these many were Word and blah, blah, blah. And so consequently, I need all this. Every time we had a refresh of hardware, I'd get everything I asked for and nobody else would.
And they were so mad at you.
And they were all mad at me. And I would say, all you got to do is this. And they go, well, it's a lot of work. Okay, then don't do it. That's easy enough.
Pay me now or pay me later.
I'll take the benefit. And I always did. And the same thing now, you get those same reports are done for you by Google.
Yep.
Here's, you know, the number of emails and the number of whatever, whatever, whatever. You print out those charts, give them to your boss. This is what I did last month. Do all of that. It takes 10 minutes to do. You give it to your boss, and at some point, your boss is either a complete moron, or he or she is going to say, yeah, you're valuable.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't help you if it's the former.
It is what it is.
But that's you know, those charts are not just pretty for a minute. They are important to your occupation.
Yeah.
Print them out, get them to your bosses.
Here's how much we didn't have to do.
Right. And take 20 minutes and create a spreadsheet that says if we needed X number of people to do X amount of work, then we would have needed Y number of people to do this. Look how much money I saved you.
Yep.
And you can plug those numbers in every month as well. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Carol from Irondequoit, New York. Hiya, Carol. What's up?
Hi. I have a Google Voice phone that I use for work, and I've been being told by people that I'm calling that my number's coming up as spam. And the only information I found is that if I make more outgoing calls than incoming calls, that's why it's happening. And I'm wondering if there's anything I can do to stop it from coming up as spam.
So there's several things here at play. Yes, so there are people who say that if you make more outgoing than incoming calls. But the point is, almost everybody does that on Google Voice. They make way more outgoing than incoming calls.
It can also depend on who had that number before you.
Right.
They may have been a spammer.
And also, it is easier now to spoof numbers.
Yep.
And so it is more than possible that somebody is simply spoofing your number. And all you can do at that point is to explain to people that they need to put you on the not spam, on their white list, on their not spam list.
There are a few websites I found for each, and it's different for every carrier, where you can register your phone number with the other carriers as not spam, and then hopefully gain your reputation as not spam.
Right.
Okay.
But and unfortunately, that's pretty much all you can, and Steve will post that link. But unfortunately, that's pretty much all you can do at this point. I'm sorry.
Change the number to something else that may not be spam.
Right.
Okay. If they put me in as a contact, it won't come up as spam. Is that right?
They can whitelist you individually. And the first on most phones, the way to do that is to put you in as a contact.
Yeah, put you in a contact. That way, when you call them, it shows up on their list. Because like with my Pixel phone, if you're not in my contact list, I usually take it as spam, and I just tell it to screen the call.
I don't answer phones if I don't know who
it is. I just screen the call. I hit the button, and you don't get in. But, yeah, if you're in my contact list, it's Carol. I might want, and I can pick it up and talk to you.
And some phones even have a VIP list, which are special contacts. And so I've got mine set that it only rings with VIPs, not even other people in my contacts.
Right.
Just the VIPs, which is my boss and my wife.
Right, right. Mine, not in that order, of course.
Wait a minute. We're not on that list?
Yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah. I have a do not disturb that goes on from X to Y overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And I have my wife and my daughter as starred items that will ignore the do not disturb. So if my daughter calls me at 3 in the morning, I will get it.
Yeah.
Carol, unfortunately, that's pretty much at this point the best you can do. Make contact with all the important people and explain to them that they need to put you in as a contact rather than a
spam. And that'll solve the issue.
What exchange does your Google Voice number say it is? Is it something local to Rochester, or was it an outside the area?
No, it's 585.
Okay, because that was one thing I always looked for when I created a Google Voice number. Mm-hmm. So if you get a phone number that's, say, New York City or Chicago, and you make a lot of calls to Rochester, that can lean you toward being spam.
Right.
So having a local phone number helps as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry.
Welcome. Yep. Good luck.
All right. Bye.
It's
always unfortunate. It's kind of the opposite, similar problem of getting spam in your email. Once your email address is on a spam list, there's almost nothing you can do to get it off except change your email address, and that's really hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really is.
So many people have my email address that, especially these old addresses. That my Roadrunner address that I've been using for 30 years now.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I like. I created I call a junk email address, that if I'm going to different sites and they want an email address, I plop that one in. And then that way anything going to that
And you it can sometimes know who sold your mm-hmm. address by the new email you get, the new spam you get from somebody.
That's one of the things that I really like about Google Mail. They have plus addresses. So if you've got, like, if I had nickfrancesco@gmail.com, I could say to, I'm buying something from Dave Enright, nickfrancesco+enright@gmail.com. And it'll still come to me, but if you ever sell that email, I know who sold it.
Okay. Cool.
Right? So, yeah it still comes to me. But, so it essentially ignores everything after the plus sign. But you can use that as an indicator to you where you, you know, where
good.
It got sold.
I did not know that one.
Yeah, I use that pretty regularly. There's also a company of called, I think it's Mailinator. It's basically inboxes on demand. So you can, it's a free disposable mail. So you can use any email address you want at mailinator.com. Unfortunately, there's no security. So anyone can, you know, you could go to Fred at mailinator.com and see all the mail there for Fred. So you want to use it for those disposable throwaway email addresses.
Yeah.
Then you can go look for the code that they send you or whatever and just never go look there again.
Bad guys always ruin everything. Firefox, Mozilla used to have a great product called Firefox Send, where you could send large files through the internet for free. Because email is limited on your file size. And it turns out that the bad guys and the worst guys were using it to send really, really bad things. And so they were trying to figure out a way to bring it back with security, and they couldn't. The bad guys kept taking over. Yeah, that's music.
Okay. Didn't hear it. Yeah. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 29 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites. It's member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. Before we get much farther, let me just remind everybody that tomorrow night at 9 p.m., we will be video chatting. So if you have a computer question you want answered then, or you just want to chit-chat about whatever we decide to talk about, you can... Oh, no, not tomorrow. Because not isn't tomorrow Super Bowl Sunday?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, no. Then no, there will be...
Well, are you going to watch the Super Bowl?
For the ads.
No. I record it and then fast through the game and watch the ads. Actually, no, I usually watch the ads online because I'll find a YouTube channel that combined all the ads together.
Yeah, right.
Because I have to say, there may not be much of an overlap between computer people and football people.
That's true, but I personally will not. I think we will not have one tomorrow night.
Yeah. So apparently in my house, we have to root for Tampa Bay because my wife lived in St. Petersburg for a while.
Okay. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Gary from Greece, New York. What's up, Gary?
Hi, guys. How are you?
Peachy, how are you?
Good. A question on browsers. When I'm on a web page, I do a search. I want to go back to the same page, the same, if you know what I mean, to the same spot on that page. And all the browsers don't do that. It takes it completely somewhere different. Is there a way to control that? You guys know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean, and the answer to that is no. It's controlled by the other end. So you can put in to the middle of a page something called an anchor, and then you you can make a link to that anchor. But that happens at the other end, and so there's no real... In some browsers, if you just hit the back button... it takes you back to the same exact spot you were.
Yeah. But not always.
But not always, and certainly if it's like the next day, no.
Right.
What I've sort of gotten the habit is on the Mac, if you command-click a link, it opens in a new tab, probably similar on Windows.
Right.
That way, the old page is still there. And when I'm done reading that page, I close that tab, and then the old page is right there where I left off.
Right. And to open things in a new tab on Windows and Linux, you either... middle click the button if you got a middle button on your on your mouse, or control click.
Another question. When I try to copy some text on a web page, sometimes the whole page will copy, and not that one particular. And I've heard say, well, click shift and control, so it doesn't work.
Yeah, again, that's often control. Many web pages attempt to prevent you from copying text from them.
Yeah.
Wow. And again, that's not something you can control. Also, in many cases, there's also the fact that formatting is so wacky on some pages that when you try to get just a little bit of text, you suddenly get everything.
Yeah.
Sometimes what can help is if there's a button for printer view or print view,
right.
You get just the text on the page without all the extra stuff, and then you can copy the bit you want.
Right.
Yeah, plus alternately, the formatting that they have built into it, and the indenting and all this other stuff.
Alternately, you can paste to a text document and then copy out the bit you want, but that's a pain, and I get it.
Okay. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye.
Some of the browsers have tried to put in a reader mode that will strip all the ads and graphics out and just show you the text. And the websites really hate that because, and I can understand because they're paid for by the ads. So you get to read it for free because the ads are there, you might notice. And that's sort of the problem that we've come to learn how to ignore the ads. And so they try to make the ads even more obtrusive and more. You know, cover the text, so you have to find where that stupid little X is.
Right.
If only the ads were actually targeted enough. See that's we need more surveillance, so the ads are better targeted.
Yeah, you sell that. That's easy. Sure. Yeah. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Mike from Fairport, New York. What's up, Mike?
Hi, guys. I was adding a Wi-Fi thermostat to my home network the other day, and my iPhone popped up with a warning that using a hidden network can expose personally identifiable information. I do have the SSID on my network hidden. That seems kind of goofy. What's up with that?
Hidden doesn't mean anything, basically. Hidden means that normal searches for Wi-Fi won't find it, but you can easily find it with any other Wi-Fi analyzer.
Right, Wi-Fi analyzer.
So hidden is not any security.
And the other fact is if you connect to a hidden network, there is the possibility you will connect to the wrong one.
Right. What we do recommend for Wi-Fi thermostats and cameras, you know, what's being called the Internet of Things, is if you have a guest network on your router, which many of them do now, connect it to that. And typically the guest network can only get to the Internet and can't get into the rest of your stuff. So if something goes wrong in that device, which it's bound to, then that can't be used as a beachhead into your network because it's only on the guest network.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll look for I think there is a guest network available on there. I'll have to check.
Yeah.
Most newer routers do have that. Some of the higher-end ones allow you to create as many networks as you like, so you could even create it.
Yeah, a special IoT network, yeah.
But don't call it that.
The router that Frontier gives you, it's probably 2 years old.
That gives you almost no control at all. You should have your own wireless router that you can control.
That
you can update when inevitable updates come out.
Right.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll look into that. Thanks a lot.
All right. Yep. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, there's been a lot of problems with router vulnerabilities and IoT devices that have had problems found in them that were, you know, they're sold cheap online and they'll never get updated. And now there's millions of devices that have vulnerabilities that are being used in botnets to attack other people.
That's right. Oh, and let me take this opportunity to remind everybody, update everything. We know to update our computers eventually, but update your router, update your printer, update your television, update your phone and your tablet and your doorbell.
Your doorbell, your security camera, exactly. your thermostats. And if they don't have an update option, get rid of them and buy one that does. Right. When you're looking to buy one of these Internet of Things devices, make sure it can be updated. And best is if the company can update it automatically so you don't have to remember to do it.
Every once in a while I go, look, almost every device has a web interface now.
Yeah.
So I just, the other day, I went to my printer and looked at the web interface, said, go see if there's an update. And there was an update, and that update was like 4 hours old.
Yeah.
I win. And so I did an update, and I went to my router and did an update, and I, you know, my television.
It's surprising.
Automatically updates. Mine does.
Yeah. It's surprising how many printers are available on the public internet.
Yeah.
And there have been some really interesting vulnerabilities found. And there's some security researchers will print a page saying your printer is on the internet and vulnerable. You need to load this update. But there was a big thing. There was a kind of a war going on YouTube subscriber lists, and there was a two people were fighting back and forth for to have the most subscribers. And so one guy decided to write a botnet to attack printers and have every printer print support my guy for the number one YouTube channel and don't support these other guys, and by exploiting a hole in publicly accessible printers.
For many years ago, we had a trivia quiz, and one of the questions was, what's the most powerful computer Apple makes? And the correct answer was the LaserWriter.
Yep.
It had the fastest processor, the most RAM, and the biggest hard drive. And at that point, I realized that's something somebody could exploit.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked into it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, the PC load letter sign, the simplest hacks are making it say other things.
Right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Will from Hampton, Virginia. Hi, Will. What's up?
Hey, guys. Not too much. Listen, I just installed a Toshiba SSD on my Toshiba Satellite, 128 gigabyte, and I'm wondering when do I want to use Secure Boot and why do I want to use it?
What operating system are you putting on it?
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant to tell you that. I was going to put Ubuntu. I'm going to put Ubuntu on it.
Yeah, you don't really need Secure Boot for Ubuntu.
Okay.
The idea behind Secure Boot is to give yet one more opportunity to keep Windows safe.
Okay.
You don't really need it on Ubuntu. And particularly when you're installing a brand new drive, Secure Boot may prevent you from doing that because it thinks you're trying to screw around with the drive.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So you have to turn it off. You might try turning it back on later, see if that works. Because what it does is it prevents you from making changes to certain areas of the hard drive. But those areas, generally speaking, are hardwired to Windows areas, and they may not be the same on any particular version of Linux.
Okay, seeing as I've already installed the drive, like I said, and my intention is to actually put on this new operating system, since it's a Linux distro, that's not even an issue then, if I understand you correctly.
Yeah, no, it really isn't an issue. Like I said, you could turn it back on again once you're done, and if there's a problem, then go back and turn it off. But you have to turn it off to install the operating system because it will actively prevent you from doing that.
Okay. That answers my question.
There you go. Have fun.
I will.
Bye bye.
Have a great day.
You too.
So
him if he had snow.
Yeah.
Because if he didn't, I wasn't going to answer his question. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. So it's in general, Secure Boot is designed to make sure nothing messes with the boot setup. That nothing can mean anything that's not Windows. So it was a joke for a while that you had to turn off Secure Boot in the Intel chips on your Mac to run macOS.
Right.
Especially if you were doing a Hackintosh, trying to put macOS on a generic PC.
Right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Ernesto from Parenton, New York. Hi, Ernesto, what's up?
Guys, you don't know what happened to me. I was doing my taxes on TurboTax.
Yeah.
I tried to save the file, and it wouldn't say file not found. And I searched that, and I searched for hours to see how I can get some information on how to turn it on. Some guy answered me on the web or somewhere, and he said, go to settings and Windows and hit a virus and the virus and security tab, and then hit something about the account and try to get further on there. And I did a lot of back and forth with it, but then it said I got to an option where you could put in what file you wanted to get. So I put TurboTax, and then it put up, it got TurboTax EXE. I said, yeah, they put that in. And I was able to save my taxes. But I said, I'm not going to do this all over again. And I don't know what's going on with Windows, but damn.
Yeah, basically, it sounds like what you did was you whitelisted TurboTax in your firewall.
And before that, it somehow got blacklisted. There has been a problem when you install software. Most of the time, the instructions say to turn off your antivirus during the installation. And that's because it's very hard for an antivirus program to know a good installation versus a malicious installation, because it works exactly the same way. So what may have happened is when you installed your tax program, that accidentally got targeted by your antivirus and marked as a virus. So you have to go into your antivirus program and whitelist it so that you can get back to it again.
Yeah, the antivirus program I have is the Windows one.
Right. But yes, it will do the same thing. It will attempt to protect you from, well, everything.
From an install, but it doesn't know the difference between you installing something okay and you accidentally installing something malicious.
Okay. So before I install anything, turn off Windows virus.
Right, but make sure that it's a legitimate program from a legitimate source, and please don't forget to turn it back on again once you've installed it.
Oh, believe me, I will, yeah. But damn, that took me for a loop.
Right. Yeah, I can see where
help.
It would.
Yep.
You would. Thanks for your help, Mike.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Ernesto. Bye-bye.
You would have, well, there may have been a message that popped up and said, identified something, yeah.
Yeah, and he ran by it so fast.
Don't notice it, yeah. And that's part of the problem with antivirus software, is knowing what's good and what's bad. There are lists of known bad programs, and every now and then something good accidentally gets on the list,
yep.
And then it gets blocked.
Yep. So there are white lists and black lists of programs, but they are not foolproof. Remember, every time you make something foolproof, God makes a better fool.
Well, it's the old game of leapfrog.
Yep.
It's no different from that.
Yep. It's so you want to be very careful as to, you know, what Ernesto did is sometimes the only way to get a piece of software to install. But A, make sure that it is, in fact, a legitimate piece of software. You got it from a legitimate source, like the manufacturer.
Yeah.
And that you then turn your antivirus back on immediately after installing that program.
In fact, we're seeing now Adobe Flash has officially been discontinued.
Yep.
And one of the biggest vectors for getting malware into your computer was a fake Flash update notice.
Right.
So now that Adobe Flash is discontinued, you should all uninstall Flash. In fact, the last update for Flash is you should uninstall me now.
Right.
Now, any message you get saying you need a Flash update is lying, because there is no Flash update.
There will never be another Flash update ever. So if you get one,
close the window.
The window. Yeah. It's a lie.
It's a lie.
In addition, tell everybody yep. about that. The word cannot spread too fast or too far.
One thing that I've always encouraged folks with, if they're really that paranoid, you know, about installing something and it requires you to take off your antivirus software and that type of stuff, then unplug your network.
That doesn't always work anymore, because some of the installers are a stub and they'll download an update.
Yeah, some
of
them
but
will.
Yeah. I'd feel a little bit more comfortable.
Better. Yeah. It's not perfect, but it's not bad.
But, you know, then you can always plug it back in. At least the core part of the program is in there, and then you can re-put in, usually restart the virus software. And like you said, if there's any updates and all that, usually that'll let that go through because the program is already there.
Right. But you want to be very careful. Look,
yeah,
you really need to be running antivirus, anti-malware, et cetera, et cetera. The problem becomes if you are one of those people who installs and uninstalls a lot of software. Well, you've got several problems there. You should be running Revo on installer, of course. Because otherwise will grow to enormous.
I love the tool. Have you tried the Uninstaller Pro?
No.
Revo Uninstaller Pro? Boy, that's got some additional features. I think they had it at Christmas time, a special. And they had 2 years, and it was cost me like $19.
Yeah.
It's still on sale, 40% off.
Yeah, it's a great deal, and it does such a great job. If you folks want to keep your machine running clean and running a lot faster, because like we've told you before, when you uninstall programs, if you're using the Windows product to uninstall or remove your, it doesn't really do it. All it does is turn off a bit, and your registry keeps growing. Whereas Revo, you will literally see it go into the registry and the subdirectories and get rid of all of it. It cleans up your hard drive, and it also cleans up your registry.
Right. And so that's an important thing because people say, oh, Windows is loading so slowly. Well, when you've got a 200 gigabyte registry, yes, it's going to take a while. It's going to take a while. So you want to be careful of what you're loading and when you're loading it. And you want to be aware that that registry just fills up with junk.
And that's why erasing your drive, reinstalling Windows, and then restoring your files from backup makes the machine run a lot faster.
Right.
Because leaving all that cruft out.
Right. If you do a full system backup and then restore that full system backup, you get exactly the same problem you're trying to resolve.
Yep.
Because it restores the registry that you were having trouble with. All right, that music tells us we are done for another week. Once again, thank everybody who called in. Remember, there will be no online thing tomorrow night. We're going to take Super Bowl Sunday off. But we will be back in next week with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with me, Nick Francesco, and you. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. Well, you were listening. Soundbites. Right here on the Truly Great. And again, we cannot stress enough that we are truly grateful to you that we can continue to be solely member-supported. Jazz 90.1, you people are the heart and soul of this network and this show. So thank you. And we will see you in just 166 hours. Be good to one another, will you?